because we can still keep going. Okay. All right, we'll round up the wagons and get this shindig soiree underway. We've been having a whole lot of fun, and I think that this is now Genesis class 26, and we're on Genesis 35. We're following up the Dinah incident, and we're going to talk about a bunch of stuff tonight and have some fun. But we're right on schedule, a schedule which I will have formalized really soon here. We usually take off the Wednesday right before Thanksgiving because obviously people are prepping for Thanksgiving. And I think this year I have 30 people, so I don't want to talk about it. Okay, they got relatives coming in from all over the world, I guess. I don't know. Anyway, we'll have Thanksgiving, and I've always got a lot of things to be thankful for, so I'm not complaining. But and then we obviously take off around Christmas, New Year's time, so we'll figure it out. But we should be exactly on track to finish Genesis in 1 year, just like we planned, which would mean, theoretically, if you guys all remember like a vote almost a year ago, John is next. So we're going to go from ancient history and madness to like the deepest theological questions in the universe. So
is that going to be all four Johns?
Yeah, probably. We might as well follow up the gospel. We're going to do the gospel, but we might as well follow up the gospel with the letters and just do it all. So we might that might last more than a year. I don't know how long that's going to last. But we're just going to keep rolling until one day we have audio of all the book, of every single word of the Bible. At that point, I'll hand it off to somebody. So keep training. One decade, and you're in. Okay. Well, I'll hand that off in a decade or whatever. But anyway, we've made some progress. I mean, we've done. What have we done? We did James. We did Ephesians. We did Romans. We did Revelation. We did Acts.
Revelations.
We did Revelation. I mean, we've been hammering away. Now we didn't have the audio capabilities for a lot of that stuff. Unfortunately, I would really, really wish that I had all of Ephesians and all of Romans and all of Acts recorded. My goodness, that would have been a major thing, but we didn't do that. But we started that last week of Romans. That's how the website starts, the very last week of Romans. And that's when we started all the recordings. But we did all of Revelation and all of Genesis, so that's great. So anyway, we're on schedule and proceeding. In the very near future, Andy and I will practice out here when it comes to filming and recording and how to get stuff on the screen and all that stuff. And don't forget this. Be sure to invite everybody you ever met. We've got, we can hire some buses from Texas if you want to bring some folks up. But I think there's going to be a pretty good contingent from YWAM, I hope. We'll see. We'll see. If it's just the same folks, then hey, I just, you guys will hear some repetitive stuff. You guys will hear some stuff you've heard before, but for the majority of the public, it's not common knowledge.
Are you going to hand out a little flyer or posters or something?
About one of two things. I'm thinking about a really brief flyer thing that's a page or two that we could give away, or I'm thinking about putting that whole chart out and binding it and then selling it for $5 or $10, whatever it costs to print at Kinko's. That way anybody who's really interested could take home a substantial thing. I think I'll probably go that route. I don't know, probably both. I don't know. But we'll see. The classes themselves are only going to be a couple hours. It's only going to be, four total hours. So it's going to be a very summary-based thing. To really cover the in-depth stuff would take a lot more time. So I'll probably hand them the in-depth stuff as a take-home. And then cover the focal points, which are going to be two or three primary focal points plus an overview. But we keep learning and growing continuously. And my new class is already underway. And this particular professor is quite a bit nicer so far than the other guy. She's a specialist in hill forts, like old British hill forts from Iron Age and Roman times and things like that, and like all that kind of stuff. And she's super cool, but we'll see. We'll see what happens. This one is techniques class, and I've got a couple things I have to experiments and excavations to do to practice. Yeah, probably because he's about 3 or 4 feet now, and I don't know exactly where. But so we had a pet lizard. It's a long story, but the short version is this is called the mini Noah story, the micro Noah. So micro Noah. Here's the short version. I'm sitting on my couch upstairs at the Black Bear one day, and God says, build a giant cage in the corner. And I said, what? Because, I mean, I hear stuff every now and then, but never build a giant cage. Like, I'm thinking, like, with lumber? And, like, what kind of cage? And he's like, here's the specifications of the cage, just like the ark. It's the micro Noah. Okay, it's a very unimportant version of Noah, okay, the much less important version. But I said, okay, and I get this vision, and I really felt like I was channeling Noah. Like, I got this vision of, like, I can see it, like, what it's going to look like and everything. And it was this 2x4 thing, and there was this space on top. And it was weird. There was this big kind of space in the bottom. And I was like, and I didn't understand it. I didn't understand why. Right? So I go and I was just obedient, you know. And I just went and got lumber and stuff and screen and started making a cage. And it was a 2x4 cage. It was really big. It was probably like 6x6x5 or 4. It was huge. And it filled the whole corner of my apartment up. And it was weird. That's just weird, okay? And this is right before I met Rihanna. So it must be going back almost 15 years or whatever. And one of the things she did later on was demolish this because it was over. But I'll explain what I mean. Because I'm going to end up pouring cement on carpet. Okay, so this is, it's like I said, it's like the Noah thing. And I just did it. So I'm building it, and I'm like, this is really weird. Why do I have this space on top, and why is there this space out here, and what's this other section for? And I really didn't get it because it was a very complicated plan. But as it unfolds, I get the door in, I get the hinges and the latch, and I get all the screen down, and everything is like coming together. So I build this cage, and now I get this big giant tree. I go out, and there's a giant tree laying in the yard. So I take the tree, and it's like a dead, like really hard, dead old tree. And it fits perfectly inside the cage. So I go in and put it in and pour cement, and I pour a cement base for the tree. And the tree is in cement, okay? And the top of the cage is like a foot away from the ceiling. And I'm like, God, why don't I just do it to the ceiling? And he's like, nope, this is what you got to build. And I'm like, okay, so I'm building it. And there's a space, and there's a cage on top. And I'm like, why on earth would there be a cage on top? The ceiling's only a foot away. That's really weird. And why is it in the corner? Well, anyway, long story short, I just built this thing. And now it's there. And I got a giant tub, like a huge, like, I don't know, bathtub looking thing. And I got cement poured on carpet. And I got a giant stick. And I got this cage. And I'm just sitting there. And I go back to watching TV. It's like a week later. I finish building the cage. I go back to watching TV. I got a cage in the corner. So the next day or two, I walk out and I see the fire chief and the police and the marshal and a couple guys out front, and they're talking like in the middle of the street, like they congregate near the front of the Black Bear, and I was living above the Black Bear. It's all above the Black Bear. They congregate out there because that's where the firehouse is. So I went out there and I said, "Hey fellas," because every time I see them, I say hi and how you doing, and we used to do the Christmas parties and all that. I'm like, "Hey fellas, how's it going?" And they're like, "Oh, we're doing great and everything." Fire chief says to me, "You wouldn't happen to have a really big cage, would you?" Just like that. And I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, we busted this meth house up in the mountains behind you. And it was a really bad meth house. And the guys are all going to prison for a very long time. They were like guns and everything. But in there, there's a giant iguana just walking around inside there. And we don't. It's a beautiful animal, and obviously it was a big pet of one of the meth guys, and we don't know what to do with it because it's not a dog or a cat. It's like a giant iguana, and we're just wondering if anybody had a place for a giant iguana." And I'm like, I have an awesome place for a giant iguana." He's like, "Why?" I'm like, I just built this giant cage. And so I get the iguana, and of course, what I need is all these heat lamps. And that's why the top is open with a cage. And the reason it's in the corner is because my main power is in the corner. I'm going to have to put in a main power switch. I'm going to have to put in all the lamps. The big tub is for water, so I got heaters in the water. That's why I need all the power. That's why it's in the corner. I need all this power. So the power can power the heaters that are in the water, so the water's warm. So the iguana will bask on the tree, which has to be in cement because it's a big, heavy iguana. If I put a random tree, it would just break. So it had to be a tree mounted in cement. The iguana lays there. His name is Sam. Okay, Victor will tell you all about him because he had him for like seven, eight years. Anyway, the iguana lays on the branch, basking, gets down, gets in the water, and I can pull the water out because he also poops in the water. I can pull the water out and clean it. I got gravel, cement, things, lamps, and I got an iguana named Sam. And Sam evidently was important enough to God to have me build a giant cage. I don't know why. I have no idea why. Maybe it's because Victor had to have some kind of pet like that when he was a kid. I have no idea. Like we've learned throughout our studies of Genesis, we don't know. God's plan is a big, complicated, weird thing, and we have no idea. No, that was on top. The underneath, we poured cement on carpet. So I'm like, why would you ruined your whole house. And now later on, I get like a girlfriend who's, you know, relatively awesome chick, going to be my wife, right? And she's staring at the scene. Now, Sam dies, and we bury Sam out back. This is like 15 years ago or 14 years ago, whatever, when I first meet Rihanna. And so Rihanna meets me after Sam has died or right around the same time. And there's a random giant cement cage in the corner of my apartment. And she, as women would do, is like, what is that? And why is it in your apartment? And why did you build a giant cage? And why is there cement on the carpet? So she demolishes the cage, because the cage is over. There's no more need for the cage. Sam's gone. So the cage gets demolished. And as you demolish the cage, you got to get rid of the carpet that has cement on it, right? So we pull the carpet to discover the beautiful, amazing hardwood floors under the cheesy, crappy, awful carpet. And then we redo all of those for a guy that does floors and wants to learn to cook, who's now the executive chef of Bourbon Brothers. And with beautiful, brand new, shiny, beautiful wood floors are what we get at the end of this project. And God is awesome and a little bit crazy. So I buried Sam out in the yard, and we had a whole ceremony because Victor had known Sam his whole life, right? So I dig a nice grave. We buried Sam. So Sam, the lizard, is like 3 feet down within a 5 or 10 foot area of my backyard, but for like 15 years. And I didn't have a box for Sam. I mean, he's like a lizard, so he didn't really fit in a box. It was weird. One day he just died. It was weird. I don't know if he was cold or whatever, but one day he just died. But I had a big plates, and we would do salad downstairs for the restaurant, and all the scraps from the salads, like the peelings from the carrots and all the pieces of romaine lettuce, he loved all that. He was just like, he had a smorgasbord every night. Like, just living the dream. Sam just had an awesome life. Anyway, I figure since it's bones and since it's buried in the ground, and since it's been a lengthy period of time, not 2,000 years, but a lengthy period of time, that I could practice and see if I can locate the bones of and excavate through proper techniques the bones of Sam and reconstruct Sam's skeleton, just like I would do with a Phoenician guy, you know, from a battlefield near Jerusalem or something. I mean, you know what I mean? Yeah, I mean, it's the same basic techniques. Obviously, it's not as long, and obviously, it's weird, but it's still the same basic techniques. So I've got two things to excavate. The other one is the cistern of the old hotel, because I found the edge of it. So I'm going to excavate the cistern of the old hotel, and I'm going to excavate Sam as my projects for the class. And wish me luck. But that is, I'll be able to make a grid and do all the techniques that I would normally do if I was in, you know, Ascalon or Gath, right? So anyway.
Well, only you would think of that.
Completely weird side note. I'm like, well, I know where there's probably a skeleton down under the ground that can probably be excavated safely and on my own property and without permits. But anyway.
Maybe that was his purpose.
Awesome. So that's a strange story, but hey, that's the micro Noah story. I'm like, yes, Lord, I'll build a giant cage. Why? You'll see later. It's not going to rain inside, is it? No, that would be a boat. This is a cage. Okay, got it. And besides, and it's a cage with lots of holes, so that wouldn't work. I said, okay, got it. Anyway, that's a true story. It's
ever pour cement on the carpet.
Hey, but you get an amazing hardwood floor out of this deal. Amazing. It's a really nice hardwood floor you get out of this deal. Anyway, so that's a very, very, very big sidetrack right there. Sorry.
You didn't put holes in that nice floor when you put the steel in, did you?
No.
No. Okay. No. That was on the other side. Everything has worked out dramatically well. As weird as the place is, as old as the place is, things have worked out dramatically well. So, all right. So we are. Continuing our story of Jacob, and tonight he's going to return to Bethel. Before we jump in, let's pray. Heavenly Father, we want to worship your holy name and thank you for everything that you do, including this time together. We want to invite you here to fill us all and fill this room and open up our hearts and our minds to the word and the knowledge that you would have us see this evening. Thank you so much for our chance to come together like this. And please bless everyone here, protect everyone here as we move forward and keep giving us these opportunities. We're so grateful. We pay all these things in the mighty name of Jesus Christ. Amen. So let's just take a moment to take a little step back, because we've got to talk about some weird stuff. And we've been talking about weird stuff the whole time, okay? It's not going to be surprising when we start talking about something weird. First of all, we have been discussing since Genesis 2, approximately, the idea that there is this lineage that came out of Eden. And we had Seth, and that's, as you know, the third child of Adam and Eve. And as you know, Adam and Eve's children are born, and there's a lot of different views. There's some very eclectic views that Eden was not really fully on earth. This is a spiritual, theological view, because Eden's so perfect, it's not really earthly. And that when they were cast out of Eden, they were therefore cast into earth. There's ideas of Adam and Eve being the very, very first people. Although that seems unlikely based on the text. On the text alone, it seems like the Adam and Eve story is a separate story. And we talked about all that, and if you want to recap that, just go listen to the first couple classes, and we've got into all kinds of astrophysics and all kinds of stuff. But we get through Seth, and we get down, and we're going to make our way toward Noah. And then Noah, who is in the line of this sort of Edenite line, if you will, is picked as the holy guy. Now, this is important because there's a connection here. Because you go through a really kind of jacked up world that everything's gone horribly wrong in, and the person that's chosen, that is the one that's holy enough to build the ark and kind of save humanity or whatever you want to call it, is Noah from the line of Seth. So we have a guy that's a hero of this story who's coming from that same line. And then after that, Noah, we continue the line. And there's all kinds of things that happen, but we're going to come to another guy. And his name is Abraham. And he's from the same line. He's from Seth. He's from Eden. He's from the same line. And we're tracking this line. And there's all kinds of squirrely stuff happening all around us. We got Lot, and Lot's got all kinds of squirrely stuff going on. And we've got Ishmael and Hagar and all kinds of weird stuff all the time. The next thing that I want to point out is that there's never not a problem. So we get to Abraham, and he has the Ishmael hiccup. And there's a whole subline, a whole offshoot that God will bless. He says he will bless them as a nation as well. We've tracked those guys, a whole separate deal. Then we get to Isaac, the son of promise, and he has two sons. He's going to pick Esau to bless. He's going to end up blessing Jacob. All kinds of weirdness ensues there. But Jacob is the continuation of the line through Isaac, through Abraham. But Esau exists. And Genesis 36 is all about all the progeny and all the stuff that Esau builds and is part of. So we have a very fascinating, and I don't want to sound too like weird or science fiction or whatever, but we have a really fascinating set of information going on. Something is weird about the line. Now, whether that weirdness is, we talked about the possibility of they look different, or maybe they glow, or maybe they're tall, or maybe they're angelic in their features, or maybe they just something about them. But all these people are impacting the world around them in very unusual ways. They're not functioning as humans would function typically. Do you understand? So, for instance, when Cain leaves, he goes off into this distant area, and it says he builds a city. Like Cain just goes and builds a city and makes a whole thing. And Esau's going to make a whole thing, right? And these are the offshoot guys. And of course, we know that the main guys are making a whole thing because we're part of it. But it's very strange. There's some type of empowerment, but that empowerment is happening too. In a less important way, perhaps, in a different way, perhaps, but it's happening to all the lineage. There's this weird things going on. So Jacob is scared of Esau, right? In the last few chapters we've read, we've seen how he planned all this stuff concerning Esau because he was scared. Now, if there was a solid delineation here where Jacob knew who he was and felt completely comfortable in his power, he would not be scared of Esau. He's not that comfortable. And Isaac certainly wasn't all that comfortable. And Abraham made all kinds of mistakes and dealt with all kinds of people, whether it's Pharaohs or Melchizedek or whatever it is. So these are just very odd stories. But we're tracking what we call the patriarchs, what we call this lineage that's going to get us to the 12 tribes of Israel. And basically, every single Jew in the world, you know, and every single Jew historically are members of some of this 12 tribes of Israel in some form or fashion. But there's always a hiccup. And there was with Ishmael, and there was with Esau. And there's going to be weird stuff with these kids going down the line. There's always hiccups, right? But there's something weird going on because the women, and we talked about this with Dinah last time, we've never had a story. So let me be very clear. We've never had a story of one of the women who we know is an offshoot of this line not having some kind of trouble. Whether it's Sarah or Rebecca or Dinah, they're always in trouble. Now, we know that it's a society, an ancient culture, you know, couple thousand-ish BC, give or take, right? So we know that we're dealing with a culture that is going to be misogynistic and male-dominated, right? And it's going to be a culture that does things like, you know, takes what they want or, you know, has slaves or whatever you want, however you want to describe it. But something is very strange about all of those stories, and we don't know how that all connects. The reason I'm talking about that now is because we're going to have Jacob, and then we're going to have the next guy coming down the line, which is going to end up being Joseph, okay? And he's going to also have this amazing, bizarre story where he's going to be super powerful for no good reason, right? And he's also going to have problems with the opposite sex. So I don't know the answer. If it's some kind of magnetism or if it's just godliness, or if they're just in charge, they have an air of authority, and so people want to connect to that air of authority. I don't know exactly how you would describe it, but it's odd. And the reason I mention it is because we need to think about how it goes off into the other directions as well. How, you know, they're being blessed in some way by this. Remember how Ishmael was given a blessing? Not the same blessing as Isaac, but another one. Remember how Esau was given a blessing? Not the same blessing as Jacob, but another one. And it continues. So this is weird. And it's repeating itself. It's like a pattern. And whenever we see patterns in the Bible, we need to kind of pay attention. You know, what do they mean? So, what's going to happen now is Jacob's going to return to Bethel, and we're going to do that in a second, and we're going to understand, like we saw the maps last time, that he's traveled down, and, you know, he's traveled, you know, to this edge of the Holy Land, basically. And on the edge of the Holy Land, he's been tracked down by the original guy, Laban. He's dealt with him. Then his brothers come up from Edom, from Mount Seir, and dealt with him. And he's dealt with each other. Then he said, come back with me. But he went the other way. And then as he went the other way, he settled in the northern parts, the far reach, kind of northern part. But then they had the Dinah incident. And now he's headed south, right? And he's going to end up back where Isaac is, which is where Abraham was, which is not that far from Egypt. It's kind of down in the southern part of the Holy Land. Okay, so this is, they're traveling these same directions in these same places all the time. It's really interesting. And we talked about that last time in respect to the Pharaohs chasing the Exodus people, because all the areas that we've been in are all these parts of what we call the Fertile Crescent. And you wouldn't expect anybody to go fleeing into the desert because they'll just die, especially a large number of people. They would just die. And they would die, except God takes care of them. And so that all is just amazing, the whole thing. And we're going to end up, you know, we're going to end up coming along with Moses. And, you know, Moses will have different types of hiccups, but he'll be sort of the rock that'll put all this together eventually. So, in Genesis 35, then God said to Jacob, arise, go up to Bethel and dwell there, make an altar there to God, and who appeared to you when you fled from the face of Esau, your brother. And Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him, put away the foreign gods that are among you, purify yourselves, change your garments, then let us rise and go up to Bethel. And I will make an altar there to God who answered me in the day of my distress and has been with me in the way which I have gone. So they gave Jacob all the foreign gods which were in their hands and the earrings which were in their ears. And Jacob hid them under the terebinth tree which was by Shechem. So Jacob is continuing to do interesting things. He's a tactical individual, as we've already discovered. He kind of does whatever he needs to do to get it done, whatever that looks like. His kids have, man, they lied to all those guys and had a whole city worth of males get surgically altered, and then went in and killed them all while they were in recovery. I mean, it is pretty crazy, but I'm not worried about him putting them away right now. We know why, because he's going into the Holy Land and he puts all the stuff away. I'm worried about him having them in the first place. They've been traveling, evidently, with foreign gods and idols and stuff like that. Jacob's understanding of God is a little fluid, okay? It's not really the Mosaic covenant, okay? Jacob's like, you know what? If I throw some, like, you know, donkey skin on or whatever, some goat hide, and, you know, kind of jack the blessing, and maybe have a bunch of different wives with some maids and stuff too, and I could just kind of, you know, maybe lie to my brother a couple times, let him go south, I'm going to go the other way. Yeah, tell my kids when they kill an entire city, you know, that, you know, you embarrassed me. He tells them that they made him, you know, look obnoxious, and I'm like, they killed an entire city. He's like, your guys are making me look bad around here. So Jacob's is a crazy cat, okay? And we talked about that last time. And now he's like, okay, I know we had all these idols and stuff out because we're traveling through those countries, and if anybody saw us, we'd be like, hey, idol, and they would leave us alone. You know, and I'm extrapolating, but I think that's what it was about. They were traveling all these places, might as well have the local idols. This is not a. I think Jacob is probably almost single-handedly the reason for the Ten Commandments. Like, honestly, I think God is like, okay, when I let my people go, like, just randomly, they Jacobize everything. So, let's reel them in. Let's no idols, no other gods. How about no killing the whole cities and stealing and lying? How about no just like lying and being a false witness, right? You know, I'm actually Esau. No, you know you're not. But yeah, no, I am. I'm Esau. Give me the blessing. I think literally he might be the core of the Mosaic law, like Jacob. And God's like, okay, I see what happens when I got a guy, and he's my guy, but I don't give him rules. He goes Jacoby on me. So, anyway, he's like, okay, now let's rack up all the foreign goods and all your crazy earrings and all that stuff. Basically, those are decorations that those other tribes, those other people, those other gods would have. He's just collecting all that stuff. He's like, all right, we're coming back home. Let's look Hebrew. Everybody look Hebrew. Okay. I mean, that doesn't exist yet exactly, but he's like, everybody look Jewish. Okay. So, I mean, that's basically what he's doing, right? And then what does he do with the stuff? Okay. He doesn't like give it away or sell it. He buries it all. Maybe we'll come back through later and I'll dig it all up and I'll need it again. Because it's probably worth money. Jacob is quite a character, right? And so they journeyed. Now they look Hebrew. Okay, so we're going to keep journeying. And they journeyed, and the terror of God was upon the cities that were all around them. So we just had something that sounded a little weird, but what was it really? What it really was a very godly action. I'm going to put away all these idols. I'm going to put away all this foreign stuff, and I'm going to honor you in this land that I'm going into that you've given me. I think that he, even though he's, like we've always discussed, he's a little bit dicey, okay, philosophically, personality-wise, he's a little shady. However, he continues to honor God. He continues to give God credit. He continues to do stuff like, okay, I don't want to. And we might be reading something into that. Maybe they had that stuff because they brought it with them, and maybe he's like, okay, we need to purify ourselves and get ready because we're going into the Holy Land. He said that. So he said, we're going to purify ourselves. We're going to change our garments. We're going to make an altar to God. So I think they went through what amounts to a pretty significant purification ceremony. Put away everything that's foreign. Put away all your weird clothes and earrings. Put away all your foreign gods and weird stuff. And we're going to get focused because God deserves that. And because he does that, he's coming in looking like a godly man, looking like the Hebrew, you know, future king or whatever, right? And he's got all this stuff with him. And so the terror of God is upon all the cities around him. They did not pursue the sons of Jacob. So the people that hear about, remember how he was worried? Because once they did that to that city, he was worried that their friends. Because if you go, the reason you don't shoot somebody in a bar, besides the fact that that's wrong, is because that person you just shot is going to have friends and family. And they're going to come shoot you. That's just like a basic rule of humanity. Okay? God forbid anything happened, but you guys we're going to have this Bible study in prison if anybody kills Bobby, because I'm going to go kill them and I'm going to be in prison. And that's okay. Like I said, it's fine. I'm going to run in the kitchen. The warden's going to love me. Don't worry about me. We'll have Bible study through the little window thing. Everybody has a phone. Don't worry. But that's how it works. You love and care about somebody deeply, you know, and this guy's got a whole city. They're going to have all kinds of friends and allies. So Jacob is rightly concerned when his sons go do that they're going to be attacked, and God fixes it. Jacob has a part to do with that. That purification process has a part to do with that. He's letting God know, I'm coming into the Holy Land and I'm getting serious. I get you. You've been with me. I appreciate what you've done. And now I'm getting serious. And God responds to that and makes sure that no harm comes of them. None of the people pursue him. None of the cities come out to attack him. And they're just scared to death. There's a terror of God on them. So Jacob comes to Luz, that is Bethel, which is in the land of Canaan. He and all of his people who were with him. And he built an altar there and called the place El Bethel, because there God appeared to him when he fled from the face of his brother. Now, Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, died, and she was buried below Bethel under the terebinth tree. If I teach this class again, we're going to have to get a terebinth tree. I mean, it's been nonstop since Abraham. We've been talking about terebinth trees. So the name of it was called Alon Bakuth. Then God appeared to Jacob again. When he came from Padan Aram and blessed him, and God said to him, "Your name is Jacob. Your name shall not be called Jacob anymore, but Israel shall be your name." So he called his name Israel. Also God said to him, so God is coming to Jacob again, but calling him Israel. "I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall proceed from you, and kings shall come from your body. The land which I gave Abraham and Isaac I give to you, and your descendants after you I give this land." Then God went up from him in the place where he talked with him. So Jacob set up a pillar in the place where he talked with him, a pillar of stone, and he poured a drink offering on it, and he poured oil on it, and Jacob called the name of that place where God spoke to him, Bethel. Okay, this has given us the name for that. And of course, the name Bethel is still there. And of course, people have used that name. A major wonderful ministry in California is called Bethel. And there's a college and everything called Bethel. So Bethel is a very big deal. But the pillar and pouring the offering on the pillar, they've excavated some temples from right after this time frame, around this time frame. And they have these random pillars in them. It's kind of interesting. They're just pillars. And they're like, there wasn't a roof. There's just this random pillar. But the reason is, God went up from him. So he built this pillar. It's like a symbol of God going up. It's like a symbol of going into the sky, a pillar, right? So, and you know, he doesn't really know exactly what to do. Like I said, there's no Bible, there's no scripture, there's nothing written down yet, there's no rules. And we really couldn't write anything down, by the way. We talked about Abraham, and Abraham's probably, if he writes at all, which is unlikely, but if he writes at all, it'll be cuneiform. It would be an early, you know, Sumerian language. It would be on clay tablets. You can't, like, hike around with 1,000 clay tablets. I mean, this is why these guys before Moses don't write it down. There's a whole bunch of reasons for Moses. Moses is a really big deal. But the technology of writing from the Egyptians that he learns in the courts of Pharaoh, he becomes fluent in. The art of war that he learns from his brother and father, who were famous, you know, powerful generals. His first 40 years, Moses' first 40 years, in the court of Pharaoh cannot be underestimated, because it's the reason he's the one, one of the reasons he's the one to write it all down. If Joseph wrote it all down, because he probably got educated once he got to Egypt, because he's running stuff, right? He's probably pretty educated. But if he wrote it all down, by the time they went to slavery, it would be lost. Mm-hmm. So we can't write it down until after the slavery, when we have the chance of building a kingdom that could protect it. So in the time after leaving Egypt, before David, is when this all has to be written down. And there's discussion about whether Moses writes the whole thing or starts it. Joshua helps and other people help. And, you know, that's all great, whatever, you know, there's a bunch of discussion, but Moses is the key to the whole thing. And even if Joshua did finish something, because we have a story in the books that Moses wrote about Moses dying. So Moses can't write about his own death, right? So the idea is maybe Joshua finished it. Well, even if Joshua did finish it, Moses taught him the war, taught him writing, taught him all the technology of Egypt. And, of course, he was raised in Egypt in the first place. He was born, I mean, obviously, he's not as old as Moses, but he was still older than a lot of the young guys, a lot of the armies. He was in charge. So anyway, this is all completely logical. And everybody has their own discussion or whatever they have. But it's all completely logical. Anyway, so that is... We're coming down to this one person has died. Now he's built this. Then they journeyed from Bethel. Now we're in 16. We're in 35:16. They journeyed from Bethel, and when there was but a little distance to go to Ephrath, Rachel labored in childbirth. She had a hard labor. Now it came to pass when she was in hard labor that the midwife said to her, "Do not fear, you will have this son also." And so it was, as her soul was departing, she died in childbirth. She called his name Ben-Oni, but his father called him Benjamin. So Rachel died and was buried on the way to Ephrath, and the Ephrath is Bethlehem. And Jacob set a pillar on her grave, which is the pillar of Rachel's grave to this day. Okay. And then Israel journeyed and pitched his tent. So we're about to change the name officially to Israel. And we've got his last son. The reason we changed the name officially right here and not earlier is because the last son who creates the tribes of Israel is now born, and he's officially Israel. He was given the name Israel by God a little while ago. And I'm assuming he started using that name right away. But it says, and Jacob set a pillar on her grave, which is the pillar of Rachel's grave to this day. Then Israel journeyed. See the change? Mm-hmm. So why is there a change? Well, first of all, one of the mothers of his kid has died. Another one of the mothers of his kid of his kids have died. And that particular person is his, like, wife, the one that he wanted in the first place, the reason for all of this, which is Rachel. But now she's dead. So we're going to be come to the understanding that we're probably not going to have a bunch more kids, at least these 12 tribe guys, okay? This is sort of like a punctuation. Rachel wasn't able to have kids. We had all these other kids. Then she had kids, right? Now she has Benjamin, right? And so Rachel is the mother of Joseph and Benjamin. And then she's dead. So this is the punctuation. And then he's Israel. And then we're dealing with these 12 kids. We're going to have a little hiccup in 36 where we talk about Esau, and we're going to start 37 with Joseph's dreams, right? So we're on the home stretch right now, okay? So Israel journeyed and pitched his tent beyond the Tower of Eder, and it happened when Israel dwelt in that land that Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel heard about it. We already got trouble. Slow down, Reuben. You got to hang on there. We need a really awesome sandwich later. Okay. So, and how did Reuben lay with Bilhah? He brought her sauerkraut, and Thousand Island, and some rye bread, and that. No, oh, man, that would be so awesome. No, okay. Anyway, that's much later. That's much later. It's still Jewish, but it's much later. Okay, so Jacob's 12 sons. Now, the sons of Jacob were 12. So the sons of Leah were Reuben, Jacob's firstborn, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun. The sons of Rachel were Joseph and Benjamin. The sons of Bilhah, Rachel's maidservant, were Dan, Naphtali. The sons of Zilpah, Leah's maidservants, were Gad and Asher. These were the sons of Jacob who were born to him in Paddan Aram-ish, because Benjamin was born when we're down here in the Holy Land. So Benjamin's important for a couple reasons. First of all, he's the baby. Okay, he is the youngest, and he's the baby. And he's also the second son of Rachel, which means Joseph's going to be extra attached to him. Joseph would have been the youngest, but for Benjamin. And so this is all very strange how this is set up. So look at the way they list it. Reuben is the first one. So Leah, who is Rachel's older sister and an official wife that he worked for, okay, it was a trick from her dad to marry off her older daughter, his oldest daughter first, to get to Rachel. But she had the firstborn son. She had all the powerhouse older kids, right? Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah. Everybody knows what his name becomes, right? So those were the kids of Leah. And then Rachel had Joseph and Benjamin, who are the youngest and appear to be sort of less important, but of course are the most important in a lot of ways. And then they list Bilhah next because Bilhah is Rachel's maidservant and she has Dan and Naphtali. And then they list Zilpah next because Zilpah is Leah's maidservant and she has Gad and Asher. So they're putting them in order of power, right? Leah was supposed to be the second, but she turned out to be first. She had the first kids and she's older. Then Rachel is his true love. And so her maidservant comes next, and then Leah's maidservant is last, right? So that's the organizational structure of how these kids are born. And of course, all of that is for very good reason. What's going to become of them, how it's going to unfold, what it's all going to mean, is all coming out of those interconnections. Why is Joseph so concerned about Benjamin? And we know why. Why is Reuben the most kind of wild? Why does he go and do what he does? He's the oldest. Reuben figures, first of all, he's going to have all the power, first of all. That's what he figures. And second of all, he's going to have all the stuff, like all the stuff. That's what he's figuring, okay? And he's the oldest. He's also probably the strongest. At least he's one of the guys that no one's going to mess with. He's the firstborn son of a guy that's insanely wealthy, right, and has 12 kids. He's the oldest. So we know for at least in this time frame that Reuben considers himself equal to Jacob. And I think that's the symbol of why he goes and sleeps with Bilhah, because he can, right? Now, there's not a law yet to say how bad that is or whatever. There's not a law yet. But he knows that's not cool, right? He knows that's not cool. But that's not a wife. So he's not doing anything that's like really, really, really bad. Like sleeping with Rachel, for instance, would end him, right? So he's also following his father's footsteps where he's kind of doing what he wants to do. So we can really see that we're going to need to reel these people in. We can see the reason for the slavery, and we can see the reason for the law. Because if these people are allowed to propagate and grow bigger, think about those 12 kids, if they all just grew up kind of like Esau and Joseph and Jacob did, right? They kind of grow up and do whatever they want to do, and then they all have 12 kids or whatever. Just think about how fast this is going to get out of hand. How crazy everybody's going to get. Because they don't have a law. One of them is going to be chosen. We don't know which one would be chosen. We do, Joseph, but it definitely doesn't look like Joseph right now. It looks like probably Reuben, right? We don't know. We know that Isaac had trouble picking between Esau and Jacob. What is Jacob going to do? He's going to have to pick a kid from Rachel, but that's going to make all the older kids very angry. That kid's not going to live. He's probably going to be thrown in a pit and maybe sold into slavery or something. I mean, I don't know. I'm just saying maybe something bad's going to happen to him. But we can see, if we really read and study Genesis, we can see why Leviticus is next. You get it? The Bible makes sense. When you just read through it and you get to Leviticus, you're like, oh no. And you get to Deuteronomy, like, are they repeating this? What is going on right now? Am I reading everything that I just read and didn't really want to read twice? I mean, come on. I mean, you're like struggling to get to Exodus. Can I get to Moses now? Right? And that's how you read the first five books, but that's not the point. The point is Leviticus makes sense after all of this. Just think what's going to happen. Think if those 12 people, and we already have Jacob as an example, and Esau. Jacob and Esau are examples, and they're both nuts, okay? What happens when there's 100,000 of these people, right, or more? You gotta figure something out, and that's why Leviticus is next. It all makes sense, right? When you go through, you know, the stories, and you get finally to the Exodus, and you get finally to Joshua and everything, everything begins to make sense. And so by the time we start to establish a kingdom or judges, what does a judge do? They judge. And what do they need in order to judge?
Laws.
You need rules to judge. So as soon as you're in the land, even though you're going to be scattered into various tribes and various sort of archaeologically, they're probably not very well organized, the 12 tribes, before we get to the king part, right? Archaeologically, they're not very organized, okay? And people are coming and going. Egyptians are coming and going. Other Canaanite kings are still in existence. And it's kind of chaos. You have to have a way to control the chaos. And so you need judges, eventually kings, right? You need judges. And this, so this makes sense why we need this Genesis. And then we need law. And then we need a land. Then we need a land, right? And rules. And then we need a king. And then the last united king, what does he ask for when he can have anything in the world he wants? I'm talking about Solomon.
Wisdom.
Why? Because he gets it. He gets all of that. How crazy everything is. If you were given a kingdom like Solomon, or you were given, you know, presidency of the United States or whatever, the very first thing you should do is hit your knees and beg for wisdom, because you've got to run a whole bunch of crazy stuff and none of it's going to make any sense to a human. So you're going to need God and you're going to need wisdom, which comes from God. And Solomon's smart enough to do that. Now, I'm not saying Solomon's perfect. Solomon is not perfect. He's got even worse problems than David had when it comes to his libido, okay? David was in serious trouble when it came to his focus, when it came to his libido. And Solomon says, you know what? I'm going to raise that a thousand. You know, but wisdom, which is weird. That whole thing is weird. So that's another whole discussion. Song of Solomon and wisdom and all that. Solomon is worthy of, like, years of study, because just the concept of the wisest person ever and the richest person ever, and then all these problems as well, is just a complicated story. But now we see kind of the flow of everything. Why? Why is it all like it is? And Jacob's kind of like the forefather of Israel, meaning he's the reason for the law, basically, in a lot of ways. I mean, obviously, he's not the reason for the law. Adam is the reason for the law. But we're tracking this history. So as we end this, Jacob came to his father Isaac at Mamre in Kirjath-Arba, which is Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac had dwelt. And Isaac is still there, right? Now the days of Isaac were 180 years, and Isaac breathed his last and died, and was gathered to his people, being old and full of days, and his sons Esau and Jacob buried him. Now there's several major points to the very end of this, of Genesis 35. First of all, Esau and Jacob are going to be back together. Esau came, Jacob was scared, nothing bad happened. Esau said, hey, come hang out with me. He said, I'm going to go this way. Evidently, there's not a problem with any of that. Esau's doing his thing. Jacob's doing his thing. They're okay. And they're going to come back and bury their father. They have respect. Maybe it's for different reasons. Maybe Isaac is being respected by Jacob because Jacob's close to God and realizes that he was the man of God. He was the child of promise that came from Abraham. Maybe that's a big deal to Jacob. Probably not to Esau. Esau probably doesn't get that at all. But that's his dad, and he loves him. And he has been blessed, just like they said. It's not going to be the same blessing, but he's also blessed. He's not having trouble. We're getting ready to get a whole chapter about how awesome his life is and how full it is. So they're going to bury him, and then we're going to have these 12 sons. And they're going to be in the land. They're going to have all the stuff that Abraham and Isaac and Jacob have all accumulated. Three generations of patriarchs, all of whom have been described as having so much stuff they couldn't even live with other people that were like them because there was too much stuff. Right? And all that's been accumulated for three generations now, and 12 guys are going to be in charge of it. And, you know, that's about to go, you know, a little bit sideways. Okay? But in the way this ends is very respectful, and we get a very solid footprint right here. We've got the 12 sons, we've got the plan, we've got several other mothers dead. We have this mentioning about Reuben, who's taking charge, basically. And then we've got this respect given based on Jacob, to Isaac. But we have Isaac's age, 180 years. So once again, these people are not normal humans. We're close enough now to relatively well-known archaeological data to know that people are living, you know, 50 to 100 years, give or take, mostly on the 50-ish side. So this is highly unusual. And we know why. We know it's because this is an echo of Eden. Now, like I said, fully comprehending this will happen in a few years from now, okay? When I get to sit down and ask questions, you know, in the edge of the throne room, okay? Or whatever. But right now, and I probably won't need to ask any questions, I'll just be like, oh, thanks. Where's my harp? Okay, so the point is... the point is...
What's that angel food cake?
Her angel food cake. Nice. That's going to be delicious. Okay, well, the thing is that we call that echoes of Eden because we know that the original people, Adam and Eve, from Eden, were made to be immortal, and we know that everybody after them has been long-lived. And we had, like, hundreds upon hundreds of years for many generations, you know, and then we started reeling it in, and it's still, even Isaac is 180 when he dies, right? Mm-hmm. And we know his father had like new families at like 140, he was cranking out new families, you know, and so we're going to get to Jacob, and you know, Jacob's going to go through. Do we get, do you have an age on Jacob, how long he lives?
147.
Okay. So 147. Do you have an age on Joseph? How long he lives?
Where did I put?
Because that's pushing it. Because we're at the end. We're at the end of Genesis at that point.
Got it. If I can, where is he? Joseph 110.
Yeah. See how? See what's happening? 180, 140, 110. So by the time they're in Egypt in slavery, they're going to come out of that human, like regular human. And I don't know if that is going to be interbreeding that's going to happen within Egypt during the slave period. I don't know if it's going to be time and generation after generation will happen. But we're watching it wind down right in front of us. It's like 800, and it goes, woo.
How old was Abraham?
Abraham, how old was Abraham when he died? Because he was starting families at 140, so he made it to...
Abraham was 175.
175.
Yeah.
So Abraham's 175, Isaac's 180, then we're in the 140s, then we're to the 110s, and then we're going to come out on the other end.
Actually, Aaron was 123, and Moses was 120.
So they're still exhibiting, even though it's not in insane amounts, but they're still exhibiting this trait, you know? Now... let me back off of that for a second, because it might not be some kind of weird genetics. It could be the presence of God. Let me clarify. We don't know what happens necessarily. Like, let's take Andy, okay? And Andy's walking home one night. We leave here. He stays for a minute to work on something. Everybody's gone. He goes to lock up, gets out. The truck's busted. It won't work. So he starts walking home. He goes to pick his cell phone up, forgot to charge it. It's off. He's like, okay, whatever. I'm just going to walk. So he walks home. It's not that hard. It's not that far. As he's walking around through the streets, headed home, God comes and just goes down beside him. He's like, ah, you know. He's like, okay, I'm gonna calm it down. So God turns the volume down, right? And he says, I just want to talk to you, you know. You're one of my children. I love you. I just want to talk to you. And he hangs out in close proximity to God. Okay. Now, we know we can't see God in full form or he would disintegrate, right? We know that doesn't work because Moses tries that and it doesn't work. You see part of his back or whatever. But he hangs out with him, kind of like Abraham did. So a lot of these guys, Adam's walking with God, right? And Abraham hangs out with God. A lot of these guys are directly, and we know Jacob wrestles with him. So we know Jacob hangs out with God multiple times. So it could be, rather than a weird genetic thing from Eden, it could be just the presence of God. In other words, Andy might then live to be 120, right? Because he gets home and he's like glowing, his hair's whiter, I guess. Even whiter. The point is, remember what happens when Moses, when he goes up and talks to God, gets the Ten Commandments, he comes down looking all freaky, right? And even, you know, we talk about that. Even in Revelation, we talk about Jesus looking different with the white hair when he comes down again. And you're like, is the presence of God having an impact? And I would have to assume, and unfortunately, I don't know firsthand. I would love to find out firsthand. But I'm assuming that being in close proximity to the creator of the universe and all the power that ever was in some type of form you can speak to is going to have some type of effect on you. You know, I know if you get around a really powerful power line, weird things can happen, right? I know you can't stand too close to a volcano because you can burn up. I mean, the point is when powerful things are near you, it alters you in some way. So it could be that everyone around them is relatively normal, including their own families. Like everyone around them is relatively normal. But the people that get close to God live these really long lives. That's completely possible. That still doesn't explain why 90-year-old women are in danger of getting grabbed and taken away as princesses. Okay, you know, that they're so hot, you know. And I'm not saying anything bad about 9-year-old women, but in general, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense that a pharaoh would try to snatch a 90-year-old, you know, as his new princess bride. But they did. They thought about it, and they tried it, and it's weird. And something's going on, but my side note is the weird ages might not be directly related to that. They might have to do with encountering God. Certainly purification from God would purify everything. So remember, we got at least one time Abraham, and probably all of them in some form or fashion. But it says that God purified him. Now, if God comes and purifies you himself, he's purifying you more than likely, once again, speculation, but more than likely, he's purifying everything. And that means cancer, cold, whatever you might have. If you got like a little polyp somewhere, that's gone, okay?
A 20-year-old getting attracted to a 145-year-old man.
Right, see? I'm saying there's something going on right there. There's something some God thing happening. And I don't know exactly what it is. But the reason I brought that up tonight is because we're going to see all the Esau stuff. And we got to ask ourselves, how much of this is in Esau? How much of this goes into those people? How does this work? Right? How does this work? But he's not encountering God. So do we get an Esau age? Because if we get an Esau age,
no, I haven't.
Then if we get an Esau age, and I haven't researched that particular question, but if we got an Esau age coming up,
if it's in this chapter,
if it's like 84, then we know it's the presence of God. But if it's like 117 for Esau, we're like, okay, it's just genetics.
So we eat a lot of figs and olives.
We got to eat a whole and a lot of
lamb
stuff from the terebinth tree. But the point of all that is that we've got 12 guys now. So here's where this story is going. We started off with one guy, and then we had another guy. You know, we had Adam, and then we had Noah, and then we had Abraham, and then Abraham had Isaac, and then Isaac had, you know, a couple guys, but we focused on Jacob. But now this has gone like this. It's gone massive on us, okay? And it has to, because the promise since Abraham has been a massive nation, that with people numbering like the sands of the sea and the stars of the sky, like this massive, massive progeny. And so we're going to have to expand rapidly to get there, and that's exactly what the sons of Jacob are, a massive expansion. I mean, it's interesting that Isaac wasn't really the focus of that expansion, because that would be your assumption. Abraham just got told everything's going to be awesome, and then you've got Isaac. Isaac should have like 12 wives and 144 kids or whatever. But that's not what happens. Isaac's relatively isolated. And we have Jacob. So how does that work? Well, maybe it's personality. You know, Isaac had a wife that he was in love with that they went and got for him and everything, right? Jacob was kind of like, he had Rachel, of course, but he also was kind of all over the place with that. And maybe it was important that the personality of Jacob and kind of the whole doing whatever you want thing built the 12 tribes, right? maybe that's part of the personality.
Well, Jacob had to go get his own wife, for Isaac's was brought to him.
Right.
You know, so he didn't have the opportunity to get more than one while they were up there.
That's a good
point. Yep, so I mean, yes. Well, that's a good point. But it also means that he was different personality-wise, you know. He was the kind of guy who would go get it himself, just like he did with the blessing. He's going to go get it himself. He's not the waiting around guy. So maybe Isaac is not the expander, because maybe Isaac is sort of the waiting around guy. Mm-hmm. And maybe Joseph's not the waiting around guy, you know. And maybe he teaches some things to those kids from his personality that, say, a Joseph would absorb and then bring with him into Egypt. And so instead of being the waiting around guy in Egypt and dying, he becomes the go-getter, go-get-it guy in Egypt. Maybe that has to do with his father. And maybe that's why he can rise up like that, because he's not the waiting around guy, you know. So this is all connected.